Now here's a story about a big new factory that's about to open up. It's going to employ a lot of people and make a lot of stuff, and it brings up a lot of questions. How is this going to change the community it's built in? How will workers be paid and treated? How much should the government do to support the factory and to regulate it? How much pollution is the factory going to produce? This story takes place in Manchester, England, and Lowell, Massachusetts in the early 1800s, in Detroit with the rise of the auto industry, at a tractor factory in the Soviet Union, and today in China and Southeast Asia, and in about 2 months in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin, with a scheduled groundbreaking for a Foxconn plant. In his new book, our guest tells us the story and history of the factory, especially the big factory, from the earliest origins to the modern day. Joshua B. Freeman is a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York Graduate Center and the author of Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
Wow, it's great to be here.
Well, I want to start in an afterword, a postscript to your book, Joshua. You follow the story from early textile mills to plants like Foxconn in China, and now it's coming full circle. Foxconn is opening a big plant here in Wisconsin. Is this a story that you're watching as maybe a next chapter in the story you tell?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's Foxconn that brought me to this book. I had never heard of Foxconn in 2010 when I came across stories about workers jumping off the roofs of their factories in China. And one of the things that struck me, besides the dramatic and kind of awful nature of that event, was the size of these factories. Some of them had 200,000, 300,000 workers. These were way beyond the scale of anything I'd ever heard of. So that's what got me into looking at the kind of prehistory of Foxconn. In a sense, this whole book is the prehistory of Foxconn. So, of course, I'm fascinated by the idea that they are now going to bring their model to the United States and specifically to Wisconsin.
And there are common themes going back from those earliest textile mills to companies like Foxconn. And one of those is a concern over the conditions facing the workers. Can you talk about, take us back to the early days in Massachusetts and Manchester, and talk about the lives that the earliest factory workers were living?
Well, yeah, the factory was a disruptive force, and one of its huge disruptions is it needed a much larger, more concentrated, different kind of workforce than had really ever been assembled before. And very often, they had a hard time getting people who would be willing to work in these factories. So often, there were very young people in England, often children and teenage girls. And they worked under extremely exploitative circumstances, very, very long hours, sometimes physical abuse, low pay, dangerous, smelly, difficult conditions, and also a whole revolution in the way people lived. You know, they had to show up at exactly the same time every day in the same place. They were under the supervision and every intimate detail of their waking hours. So this was very controversial. There was a great deal of criticism. So the miraculous productivity of the factory as this new thing was from the very beginning accompanied by questions about labor exploitation and also environmental degradation.
And a theme that comes up again and again is how the government supports or regulates factories. And in the early days of the English free market, the government would enforce labor policies where if you quit, it was illegal. You were violating your contract.
Yeah, it's a funny term to use. I know what you mean by free market, but it was anything but. In fact, some of these kids were there because they were in orphanages, in poorhouses, and they were apprenticed by these poorhouses to these factories, which meant that they were legally obliged to serve out a term, 7-8 years. If they ran away, they could be arrested. The state, the government, has been involved in factory production from its very beginning until today. You can't really do this without a governmental infrastructure. It may be subsidies, or it may be laws, or it may be building roads, or it may be tariffs even. But there's no such thing as a factory divorced from the sets of rules and regulations and capacities of government.
And another theme, we see a concern over the decline of manufacturing in the United States. We've seen this again and again. A place has dominated manufacturing in one sector or another, whether it's textiles or steel or automobiles or whatever. And then things change and the center of manufacturing moves to a new place. It's almost like there's this life cycle of any given region's manufacturing industry.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the things that really came clear to me as I worked on the book, that this model of the large factory has been with us for 300 years. But factories, individual factories, don't last anywhere near that long. You know, and if they last, you know, a couple lifetimes, that's a very long time. The initial advantages of being at the forefront of technology, the biggest scale, and often taking advantage of workers who were previously outside the workforce, eventually dissipates. You know, other companies start with better technology, workers demand higher wages, costs go up, and eventually the factory has to, you know, move on or even shut down. And so we see this kind of, as you say, life cycle. So what sustained the factory model is its reappearance over and over again in different places, not staying, you know, on a long-term basis in one place. So, you know, I would say, for example, that, you know, in planning the Foxconn plant in Wisconsin, everyone should recognize that this plant will close at some point. You know, it's not going to go on forever. You know, it may go on for 20 years or 40 years, and then there's going to be an aftermath. And often the aftermath of the large factory is not good.
Talking to Joshua Freeman, his new book is Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. I just want to follow some of the interesting twists and turns for a couple of moments, Joshua. One is, you know, as we have the rise of automobile plants in the Detroit area and the huge River Rouge plant and others, some of the same architects and designers and organizers of those plants ended up working in the Soviet Union to build and design their mega factories. Can you talk about the weird overlap there?
Yeah, you know, it's not a well-known story, but when the Soviet Union in the late 1920s launched a crash industrialization drive, they recognized they didn't have the technical or intellectual capacity to build what they wanted, which is the most modern cutting-edge plants. They turned to the West, especially the United States and Germany, to hire companies and skilled workers and architects and engineers. And companies like Ford went to the Soviet Union and helped build plants, in some cases that were basically replicas of their American operations. So the template of the large mass production factory came from the United States to the Soviet Union. It was a different social system, but the factory itself was not all that different in Soviet Russia than Detroit. And then from Soviet Union after World War II, it spread to Eastern Europe and eventually to China.
And there was this idea that you write about that capitalism, okay, communism, whatever. There's a logic, a hierarchy, an organization to the factory that becomes its own ideology, no matter where you put it in the world.
Yeah, you know, this was a much debated issue. You know, some people in the Soviet Union said, no, you know, we should come up with a socialist system of production that would, you know, give workers more power, be less exploitive. But they lost the debate for another group that said basically the factory is a tool and we can use it to advance a different kind of society, just like it's being used in the West. So as things played out, I think your description is a very accurate one.
And you also follow not just the economic side of things, but you look at how factories transform cultures and the reactions in the artistic world, the journalistic world, the world of fiction. Can you talk about some of the things you came across along the way?
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, almost from the very beginning, people, particularly artists, recognized something new and exciting and different and dangerous was out there. So, Daniel Defoe, you know, who we associate with Robinson Crusoe, he was like a factory tourist in the early 1700s. He goes, visits a silk factory, and he writes with kind of gee whiz wonder at the marvelousness of this. And we see the same thing through the years. Maybe the high point of this in the United States was in the 1930s and 1920s, when some of the best-known photographers and painters and filmmakers were just completely fascinated by Detroit. And especially the Ford River Rouge factory, which is the largest factory to this day that's ever been built in the United States. And painters like Charles Sheeler and photographers like Margaret Bourke White and filmmakers like Charlie Chaplin all saw the future. They saw modernity, for better and for worse, in the giant factory. And so they felt that if you want to understand what our society is, this is the place you go.
And I want to focus in on one of those Detroit examples, Diego Rivera and his famous four-wall mural at the Detroit Institute of Art now. And it loves the factory. It hates the factory. It's capitalistic. It's socialistic. There's so much going on. Can you just talk about that as an artifact of the factory?
Yeah, it's a wonderful, wonderful assemblage. Detroit Art Institute grew up with Detroit, which grew up with the auto industry. And the head of the museum commissioned Diego Rivera, who's also already pretty well known, to do this mural. It was actually funded by Edsel Ford, the son of Henry Ford, who was on the board of the museum. And Rivera came, and he was sort of shown around the plants and around Detroit by both Henry and Edsel Ford. And he was completely intrigued by it. And he spent about a year painting this mural. He was accompanied by his wife, Frida Kahlo. And the finished product, I think, is exactly the way you describe it. It sees the factory in its sort of Promethean glory, man seizing, you know, the energy, fire from the gods and sort of creating this amazing machine, to which in some ways people are subsumed to it. I think, though, ultimately it's actually celebratory. It sees in it a kind of great triumph, even as it shows its downside as well. It like all great art, you know, it's not a simple portrayal, but it's still there. It's still wonderful. I encourage everyone to go see it.
We're talking to Joshua Freeman right now with the City University of New York. He's the author of Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What questions, what thoughts do you have about factories, how they've changed the world, how they've changed your local community for better, for worse, both depending on what time period we're talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the history of factories and how they transformed the world we know today. Joshua B. Freeman is with us from the City University of New York. He's the author of the new book, Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, and maybe your experiences if you have worked in your family or if you're in a factory or if your family members have worked there in years past, if factories have been part of the economy of your town, or if their closure has affected it. Call in now at 800-642-1234. And are you hoping to work in the new Foxconn plant coming to southeastern Wisconsin? Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Don't want to talk about factories and not bring up unions, Joshua. And you talk about these mega factories as being a breeding ground for union activity in a lot of ways, and leading factories to, or companies to, move away maybe from these very biggest factories.
Well, yeah, I think that's very much true. You know, these factories in different places and different times have been arenas of struggle between workers and their owners and managers. And, you know, in the United States, mostly companies were successful in keeping unions out of the biggest and most advanced, you know, steel and auto and electrical equipment plants until the 1930s. And then you got, under the New Deal, a new drive of workers to organize in the face of harsh conditions. And at that point, what had been a great advantage to these companies, the integration of production in a series of mammoth facilities, highly efficient, turned into a great disadvantage, because by controlling just a few factories, be it the Chevy plants in Flint or a key factory like the Ford River Rouge plant, workers could shut down an entire company. So they became kind of choke points. Now, this led to union triumph, and in my view, this led to the kind of golden age people are often nostalgic about, where you had the combination of highly efficient production and strong unionization, which meant that the gains of this system were quite widely shared. And you know, this is a period of rising income and security for American workers. You know, I think when Donald Trump says, you know, let's make America great again, at least subconsciously, he's harking back to that moment in the 1950s and 60s when that unionization of the giant factory really paid off for working people. But over time, you know, a lot of companies really hate the possibility of this kind of choke point, and they begin to disperse their factories, at least in the United States. So today we have no factories on the scale that the River Rouge once was. It once had 100,000 workers. Today it has between 5,000 and 6,000 workers. And so we have many smaller factories dispersed to prevent just that kind of mobilization of worker power. Now, in other places where there's less of a threat from workers, be it in Germany where there's better labor relations, or places like China where there's a more autocratic system, there you continue to see the giant factory model. But we don't have it in the U.S. anymore.
I want to bring in a caller now. Owen is with us in Wauwega. Owen, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think this is a fascinating subject here, and I'm going to probably end up buying your book. But anyway, I found a lot of really neat ruins of factories in Lawrence, Massachusetts, Athol, Massachusetts. I know those areas. Holyoke, Massachusetts. The urban decay there is just so fascinating to me. Even Gary, Indiana, you know, just that wasn't very long ago. What's happened to Gary because of, you know, industrialization and the turn that industrialization has taken in our economy, and you can really see what it's done to a whole community, like in Gary.
Owen, thanks for the call. And Joshua, you mentioned earlier when the life cycle of the factory ends, it's not pretty. Whether we're talking Gary 30 years ago or Massachusetts, Lawrence and other cities, 150 years ago? I don't know.
Well, yeah. Those Massachusetts centers were some of the most advanced plants in the entire world when they were built in the 1830s and 1840s. And by the early 20th century, the first of them were shutting down. And by the 1950s and 60s, the very last of them were shut down. It became an extraordinarily depressed area. Some of these buildings get repurposed, you know, the artist studios or warehouses. But these communities have a hard time recovering because they grew up kind of organically around the factory and the whole structure of the place. The social structure, the economic structure, the physical structure was built around these factories. And when you take them out, it's like you take the heart of the community away. I think one of the most difficult situations, say, is Flint, where you see the same sort of thing.
Thanks for that call, Owen. We're talking to Joshua Freeman. His new book is Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World. A big change we're seeing now, and again, this is not necessarily a new thing I find in your book, is mechanization, technology changing the nature of factory jobs. Can you talk about how that affects the life cycle of these big factories?
Well, it's certainly true that, you know, mechanization and automation is a very big issue. It's not a new thing. The factory itself, in a sense, was built on the idea of automated equipment or mechanized equipment. But it continues to unfold. In the United States, it causes much more job loss in factories than the factories moving to other countries. But what I think is not true is this idea that we are past the age of the factory. You know, robots are taking over everything. You know, in the United States, factory employment is only about 8% of the workforce. But globally, it's close to 30%. And we're pretty near an all-time global high in terms of manufacturing employment. So, you know, certainly we'll continue to see more introduction of machinery that will reduce the needs for human labor in certain kinds of jobs. But I think the age of the factory will be with us for quite some time yet.
And what are you watching for next? Your final chapter looks at, well, you go from China and then plants in Southeast Asia. Now we've got Chinese plants coming to the United States. What are you watching for in the future?
Well, you know, I think we're going to continue to see this pattern of migration of particularly very labor-intensive factories to cheaper areas. And sometimes this is almost like going back in time. You know, some of, for example, the garment factories that have moved to Bangladesh look like sweatshops on the Lower East Side of New York 120 years ago. Other times, more sophisticated plants are moving. China is heavily involved in Africa now, and some Chinese firms are beginning to set up branch plants in Africa, much, much cheaper than in China or move within China itself. So I think we're going to continue to see that. But, you know, patterns do change. Costs of things like transportation, communications change the equation. as do political interventions. And, you know, it's way too soon to know, but, you know, if we do see a increase in tariffs on a worldwide basis, that could change the pattern of plant location also.
And if you were asked to give advice to a policymaker who was looking to boost manufacturing in the 21st century here in the United States, what would you tell them based on the last couple hundred years of the factory?
Well, you know, I think factories and more factories in the United States are a good idea. It's something I agree with our president about. And I think manufacturing employment would be wonderful to see that go up. But I also know that you know, factories do come and go. And therefore, you know, if you're going to invest money, don't invest, you know, stealing the plant from Louisiana and taking it to Alabama, or, you know, in my view, even to get a company from abroad, but attract factories and industry by making your place attractive with better infrastructure, with better environmental infrastructure, with higher educational standards, with social systems that will help support these workers. Avoid the past where you have a kind of one industry town where you are dependent on the whims of a private factory owner. You may put up a $2 billion to get that factory there, but in the end, if that factory owner decides, hey, this isn't working out, we're moving to, you know, Ethiopia, what's going to happen to communities? So, yes, absolutely, work to get manufacturing, subsidize it, but let's do it in a way that speaks to the broader interests of the community and recognizes if we're going to give private factory owners huge subsidies, there should be some social say in how that factory develops.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Joshua Freeman. We've been talking about his new book, Behemoth, A History of the Factory and the Making of the Modern World.